I think it's absolutely necessary that that Section 377A is struck down. And it's a good thing that countries like India and Singapore have got rid of it. But the road ahead is still long.
Last year, Singapore became the latest Asian country to repeal its colony-era sodomy law. Known as Section 377A of Singapore's Penal Code, the legislation criminalised consensual sex between two men. However, similar laws persist across Southeast Asia. Remy Chu, Vice Chair of the IBA LGBTQI+ Law Committee and Managing Director of Remy Chu Chambers in Singapore, was one of the lawyers involved in the fight to declare Section 377A as unconstitutional. He talks about the long campaign for repeal and the next steps for queer rights in Singapore from a legislative standpoint.
The first attempt to repeal 377A came in 2007 when the issue was debated in Parliament. When Section 377 was repealed, but Section 377A was retained, there was a signature campaign as well as a movement in Parliament to try and repeal 377A, but that was not successful. Two lawsuits brought, one in 2011 and another in 2013, that challenged the constitutionality of 377A in the Singapore courts. Now, fast forward to 2018 November, after the Indian Supreme Court ruling in Navtesh Singh Johar, the community in Singapore thought that the time was ripe for another challenge in the courts, and so launched a series of three lawsuits in 2018 November. This resulted in a decision by our Court of Appeal in February 2022 that ultimately decided to keep 377A, but was extremely lukewarm in its support for retaining 377A. The first set of challenges I did was in 2013, and the last one I did ended in February 2022. So it was almost a decade, in a sense, kind of in the trenches with this case. The original case I did started or was originally filed in the High Court in November 2012. And very poignantly, the date Parliament decided to finally repeal 377A was exactly 10 years to the date that the first challenge I did in 2012 was launched. So it was a great sense of relief that the work had eventually come to something. It was a great sense of relief to all LGBT persons who have been laboring under the label of criminality all these years. And it was a sense that finally we were going to start taking the first step ahead towards equality, even though that fight is very far from complete. In repealing 377A, the government also introduced a constitutional amendment to make clear that the definition of marriage and the government's ability to set policy according to the current heteronormative definition of marriage could not be challenged through the courts. So in one sense, it was two steps forward and one step back. However, the government has said that in the future, if a future parliament were to decide that the definition of marriage were to change, that is a decision that can be made through a future parliament. So it was not going to amend the constitution to hardwire the heteronormative definition of marriage into the constitution itself. This means that if the question of gay marriage were to arise, it can be determined by way of a simple majority by a future parliament. It just cannot be challenged or judicially determined through the courts. Discrimination didn't start with 377A in 1938, and it's not going to end by the stroke of a legislative draftsman's pen. Because 377A has been around for so long, A lot of the discrimination associated with it is hardwired into legislation as well as policy. So we see that discrimination in sexual education policy in schools. We see it in media policy, in free-to-air broadcast and censorship. We see it in the military, and we see it in public health. And we also see it in the lack of protections for LGBT persons in the workplace. So I think before the large questions about marriage are asked and answered, there is a lot of everyday discrimination that we are going to call out, unwind, push back, and then use each front in this battle as the push for the next advances in equality.
Pavan Mano, a research fellow in racism, racialization, and gender at University College London, speaks to the historical context of anti-queerness in the Southeast Asian region and the legacy of colonialism.
The institution of Section 377 was not just a hostility to same-sex behavior, but the discovery that colonial officials were sleeping with native boys. So there is that distinction between colonialists and natives that was threatened with a kind of rupture. Because if that boundary was not being maintained, then the superiority of the colonial state and colonial officials would be disrupted. So a lot of Section 377 is kind of institution has to do as much with hostility to queerness and homosexuality as it does with a maintenance of a certain kind of racial hierarchy, ensuring that there was not a kind of racial mixing involved. And that has, in its more contemporary sense, been taken up as a sort of purely, in a purely homophobic sense. But I think in its initial institution, there was that kind of maintenance of a colonial hierarchy as well as a racial hierarchy, as well as this kind of sexual hierarchy. What's happened in Singapore with the repeal of Section 377A is the result of a long period of sustained campaigning by LGBT activists, community organizers, who they've put in a lot of hard work. And what happened at the end of 2022, the repeal is the result of that. So the simple answer to that question is pressure on states and governments to repeal the law. That's the way forward. Well, in other countries, let's say, it's difficult to protest. You know, and I think that bears mentioning that it's difficult to protest, it's difficult to articulate dissent, it's difficult to push back against the state. But it is that kind of pushback, it is that kind of speaking up that will compel a state to repeal the law. We might want to think about these kinds of repeals and striking down these unjust laws as necessary but insufficient moves, you know. And in particular, the legal scholar Catherine Frank tells us that it might not, the law should not be thought of necessarily as a sort of the source of liberation, that the various forms of oppression and discrimination that non-normative genders and sexualities face in society don't originate from just one law. So, I think it's absolutely necessary that Section 377A is struck down. And it's a good thing that countries like India and Singapore have got rid of it, but the road ahead is still long. The shadow of heteronormativity is still being cast over lots of minorities, lots of people who don't fit in with a kind of prescribed way of living according to heterosexuality.
Ryan Silverio is Executive Director of ASEAN Soji Caucus, a network of human rights activists based across Southeast Asia. They discuss the importance of queer advocacy in the region and what the future of LGBTQI plus rights looks like in Southeast Asia.
I think the repeal of Section 377A in Singapore has been long delayed. Yes, it's a good development, but I think it was done in a cautious manner whereby the government has also instituted a law that, you know, restricts the definition of family and reaffirmed the heteronormative basis of the family. But I think given that the law is already there and we need new good examples of how progressive developments are being made, then perhaps other countries can follow suit. I think it'll take a matter of time to see whether other countries in Southeast Asia will follow it. Well, so far in the region, we still have countries like Malaysia, Brunei Darussalam, and Myanmar. Myanmar, there were some already discussions in the past, but then the military junta took over, and as such, some moves forward have been stalled. I'm still optimistic, but at the same time, I think we still have to look for other opportunities where we can push forward LGBT rights advancement in the region. The entire Southeast Asia is a very crucial political space, and there are many issues happening, and the issues are quite different across each country. So, for example, reprisals against LGBTQI activists in the context of, say, Malaysia or Indonesia, these are something that we have to give serious attention. Or the lack of democratic political space in Myanmar, which has pushed a lot of activists to get out and seek safer locations to continue their human rights and pro-democracy work, is something that we also need to give attention to. At least in the past 5 years, there's been a significant blossoming of LGBTI organizations in different communities, and mostly coming from very young groups, mostly unregistered. And at the same time, there's also organizing around diverse identities. For example, the intersex movement is becoming more strong. Non-binary persons are getting their voices stronger in different spaces. And I think this is a positive way forward. I can also foresee a stronger alliance of LGBTI activism with broader social movements. I think I've been noticing this amongst the work of different organizations, that we do not allow our work to be in silos. For example, in Southeast Asia, we have the annual ASEAN Civil Society Conference, ASEAN People's Forum. So this is the civil society space every time the ASEAN official meetings are happening. And at least since 2011, actually, even as way back as 2006, there have been articulations of SOGSE or LGBT rights in the concluding conference statement. That concluding conference statement is very crucial because it serves as our submission to the ASEAN governments of how ASEAN peoples, ASEAN civil societies think that ASEAN has to do. It's like our advocacy agenda, our collective advocacy agenda in the region. So the fact that LGBT rights is there, it to some extent we can see that there is awareness and acceptance of our issue as part of the broader move for social justice.